transmission of light, assembly, gathering the mind, other background before jumping into the stories of the ancestors. The transmission of light, a record, is a kind of spiritual genealogy of the Soto Zen ancestors from Shakyamuni Buddha up through Ko-un Ejo, Dogen's disciple, put together by Keizan. He collected the old stories and offered his comments on them. And along with Dogen's Shogogenzo, these are sometimes considered the two great teaching treatises of Soto Zen that define the style of our practice. Maybe more attention is given to Dogen and the Shogogenzo. Dogen's just a literary genius and considered one of the greatest philosopher, poet, yogis in the world, and surely in Japan. And it's often said that Dogen is considered like the father of Soto Zen and Keizan the mother of Soto Zen. He was a guy, but it's an interesting idea that goes way back. One way of comparing this Dogen and Keizan as these two co-founders, Keizan's is the fourth generation ancestor in Japan after Dogen, so they live not long apart. Sometimes it's said Dogen's like the dignified father, rigorous and stern, and Keizan's like the compassionate mother, mild and gentle. Sometimes when we read Keizan's records, he maybe doesn't sound so mild and gentle, but something about that kind of spirit is one way of looking at these two. Dogen founded this small, conservative, elite monastic institution. Only had like a few students, actually. It was quite small during his life. But he produced a lot of writings and recorded talks. And maybe that's natural. It was small. It was the beginning of that lineage in Japan. And these few generations later, Keizan integrated and popularized this new school of Soto Zen, partly by assimilating other traditions. And particularly he's known for making Zen more popular by bringing in all these esoteric ceremonies. And we might think, in America, it's almost like the opposite, right? Maybe that would be like the minority of people interested in esoteric ceremonies, and the popular version is like Zazen for the masses. But it seems like in Japan, and I think in Asia in general, it's kind of like the opposite. I was just at this conference of Zen teachers where we had a speaker, Paula Arai from Japan, and she said something like of the millions of so-called Buddhists in the world, mostly living in various countries in Asia, a very tiny minority of Buddhists, those who consider themselves Buddhist, have ever practiced meditation. We consider silent sitting meditation. And but they've all they all take part in ceremonies and ritual. And I think, again, I thought, oh, in America, it's almost like, almost opposite maybe. Like, I think probably the majority of kind of American-born Buddhist kind of conversion Buddhists, the majority have done meditation, and maybe the majority have done some ritual, but there's probably plenty who haven't done any of much at all. So this is a unique aspect, I think, of American Buddhism. But I think we can see that, like in Christianity, say, a small minority of Christians have probably done like contemplative prayer, but they've all done the ritual, basic rituals of Sunday church. And I think it's very similar in Asian Buddhism. And Dogen was this kind of purist, shikan taza, just sit, there's no need for anything else. It's actually kind of a radical thing in his time. It wasn't so popular. And so Keizan, of course, honored Dogen Zazen. It's the Zen meditation school, after all, but brought in more ritual ceremonies that people, why do people, you know, the masses of people resonate with that? Maybe because it feels like, maybe it's less effort. It's like you're carried by a ceremony. Step into it, something larger, and the group creates something larger with all the senses are involved. There's sound and sight and smells and maybe sometimes tastes and touchables and activities. So maybe more accessible. And there were Zen rituals, of course, of it. Keizan particularly was drawn to the Shingon school, which is the Shingon is the Japanese word that means mantra, literally true word. It's the mantra yana of Japan, and this is kind of like the esoteric school. And maybe people are drawn to that type of thing, particularly because it has a sort of magical quality. It's something, it's larger and it's mysterious, and it's touching on the inconceivable. Maybe the exoteric rituals are more like, yeah, we're you know, making offerings to Shakyamuni Buddha, the founder. That's pretty understandable. Esoteric thing is we're actually maybe becoming one with Vairochana Buddha, the Dharmakaya, inconceivable cosmic Buddha. That's maybe like something bigger. That the mystery in that maybe draws some people. At least this seemed to be the case. This worked for Keizan. The people were into it. Also, sometimes said Dogen was more like focused on the internal, deeply exploring the inner nature and studying the self. And Keizan was more focused on the external, looking outward and boldly spreading the teachings. So that's a little bit about comparing Dogen and Keizan. So something that I just came across the other day, I'd never heard before, this kind of connection between these two ancestors, besides just, you know, their lineage. They never met. Dogen and Keizan were not alive at the same time. But when Dogen first came back from China to Japan and moved into Kenninji, which was a Rinzai Zen temple in Kyoto, he was practicing with that Sangha, but he had his own unique take on practice, and people came to him for guidance and instruction. And apparently most of those who came for Dogen's teachings were women in these early years, and and lay women, actually mostly, not ordained nuns. And one of these lay women was Myoji, was her name, and she later gave birth to Keizan's mother. I didn't know that before. So they have that kind of connection, right? Keizan's mother is Acharya Ekon. We chant her name, yeah. Mm-hmm. Ekon, that's Keizan's mother. So Myoji was a devoted Zen practitioner. And then her daughter, Ekon, was also very devoted, particularly to Kanon Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva of Great Compassion. And she, when she was pregnant, she made many prayers that her baby would become a great practitioner of Dharma, which seemed like it had some effect. And apparently, as the stories go, for the first 7 months of her pregnancy, she would do 1,333 prostrations to Kanon every day with these prayers. And maybe the last 2 months of pregnancy is like, maybe you don't do that anymore. Prostrations might crush little Keizan. And then Keizan was born on the grounds of a Kanon temple in Echizen, or present day Fukui, which is the province where Eheji is. So Keizan was born right near Eheji. Dogen was no longer alive, but the first Soto Zen temple was like in his neighborhood. So whereas Dogen traveled all the way to China to find this Dharma, already by this fourth generation, it was like you didn't have to go far. Actually, I think that I heard Keizan never even traveled much around Japan. His devoted mother kind of gave him to the monastery at age 12 or something, and at Eheji. And he did travel some later and set up different temples, but I think not the farthest reaches of Japan, and he never went to China. And then quickly Soto Zen was spread throughout the country. Still in modern day Japan, there's like the two head temples of the school are Eheji, founded by Dogen, and Sojiji, founded by Keizan. Somewhere along the over the years, Sojiji moved location, but it kept its identity as Keizan's founded temple. And Soji, in this Sojiji, in this case, Soji is a translation of Dharani. So again, this is Dharani is like a mantra. So Keizan's kind of Vajrayana emphasis. He named his temple after this and set it up as a kind of like Zen temple, but with this we might call Vajrayana. Maybe that's more a Tibetan term, but like the Mantrayana practices, which some people criticize. It's not pure Zen anymore. And maybe over the centuries these different styles would blend and mix. So Keizan put together closer to the end of his life, this transmission of light record of the ancestors, partly to celebrate this unique Zen lineage and offer like kind of like the essence of his teaching about Zen practice. And the more I look at this Denko Roku, the more I really appreciate it. This starting with today's ancestor. This is a wonderful story. I just do one more introductory paragraph here from the Francis Cook, who is an American Zen priest. I don't think not alive anymore. Ellen knows him, knew him from LA Zen Center. In the course of documenting the ancestral succession over the generations, Kazon centers his talks primarily on two topics. One is the necessity to be totally committed to achieving awakening, to take Zen life most seriously, and to make a supreme effort in Zen practice. This is also a focal point in Dogen's writing, and both of these ancestors are equally concerned with the training of monks and selection of successors. The second emphasis, and indeed the overwhelmingly central focal point of all these chapters in this record, is the light of the title. There's light, ko, means, as in Kokyo, my name is Luminous Owl. It's like luminosity or light. It is this light that's transmitted from teacher to disciple as the disciple discovers this light within him or herself. In fact, once the light is discovered, this is the transmission. The transmission of light is the discovery of the light. It's not actually given by someone else. The light is one's Buddha nature, or true self, with a capital S. Kazon uses a number of striking and provocative epithets and titles for this true self, including true self, that one, that person, the old fellow, and the lord of the house. Whew. Such language is uncommon in Dogen's writings, as is the focus on discussing the existence and nature of this old fellow. But that is part of what constitutes Kazon Zen as distinct from Dogen Zen. I think this is true when you get used to the writings of these two ancestors. Dogen has similar teachings, but maybe Dogen is a little more cautious about talking about this old fellow, that one, there's someone here you must know. Sets it up a little bit like there's something here, actually. And maybe Dogen leans a little bit more towards there's nobody here. the emptiness side. There's empty stillness and there's bright, clear light. So a few years ago we started these stories, I think with Bodhidharma, who is the 28th ancestor, and now up to the 49th. Shwedo Jurjian, or Secho Chikan Dayosho, whose name we chanted this morning. So this is in China, a few generations before Dogen arrives on the scene. In fact, Secho Chikan's student was Tendo Nyojo, who is Dogen's teacher. So this sesshin, I intend to finish this record. The 49th ancestor was Zen Master Shwedo Jurjian, Secho Jikan in Japanese. His name means snow drain. Snow drain, wisdom mirror. When Tsung Chiu, the previous ancestor, that's Tendo Sogaku, Daisho, when he was at Mount Tiantong, Tendo-san, one day he entered the hall. So this is, we're talking about the case that begins each of these chapters is an awakening story of this ancestor. So this is how Secho Jikan discovered the light. So his teacher, Tendo Sogaku, on Mount Tiantong, which is where Dogen met his teacher also, one day entered the hall and said, "The world-honored one spoke with a hidden meaning, but it was not concealed to Kashyapa." To Maha Kashyapa is the first ancestor, right? Maka Kasho, Daisho, the first Indian ancestor, student of the Buddha. So it's a quote from the Nirvana Sutra, which was this particular quote from the sutra was getting brought up a lot by Zen teachers in China in these days. It's interesting. People pick up on little pieces like, whoa, that's like, this sounds like there's some Zen in here in this sutra. So he was giving this Dharma talk, right, and said, "The world-honored one spoke with a hidden meaning," or another translation would be, the world-honored one, by the way, is the Buddha. The world-honored one, the Buddha, had intimate speech, or intimate words. This is the name, actually, of Dogen, one of Dogen's Shobogenzo essays, called Intimate Language or Intimate Words, Mitsugo. That's the phrase here. The world-honored one had intimate language or spoke with a hidden meaning. These are different translations. But it was not concealed to Kashyapa. So there was this intimate way of talking, this secret words. Of course, Keizan's going to unpack this later, what this is about. But this is the story. The world-honored one spoke with a hidden meaning, but it was not concealed to Kashyapa. When Shwedo, Secho Jikan, heard this, he was suddenly awakened to its profound meaning. He realized Satori. Standing there in the assembly with the others, his tears fell. He unconsciously burst out, "Why haven't I heard this before?" Tendo Sogaku finished his talk and afterwards summoned Secho Jikan. He asked, "Why were you weeping during the Dharma talk?" And Secho replied, "The world-honored one spoke with a hidden meaning, but it was not concealed to Kashyapa." Tendo Sogaku gave his approval, saying, "You must be the one that Yunju predicted." Yunju was an earlier Chinese Soto ancestor. That's the story. This is conveying the style of our lineage. When I heard the world-honored one use this intimate language, but Maha Kashyapa didn't hide it, or it wasn't hidden to Maha Kashyapa. Now, Keizan gives him a little story, a little history about Shwedo Jurchen, this 49th ancestor's life. He was from the Wu family of Juzhou when he was a boy. his mother washed a sore on his hand. So I think this way it's put here is, this doesn't make that much sense, but here's another translation. When he was a boy, his mother noticed a mark on his hands when she was washing them and asked, oh, what's this mark on your hands? And he replied, my hand has the marks of a Buddha's hand. So these kind of like child prodigy stories as a little kid. Ooh, as maybe mother thought, oh, what's up with him? When he grew older, his parents died. He went to see Chun Xie, Qing Yao, and Chang Lu. At that time, Sun Chu was the senior monk, and he thought that our ancestor here, Shui Do, was a vessel of the Dharma. So basically it's saying he was practicing in different places with different teachers, and the one who gave this Dharma talk about the intimate words was like, I think it was like the Shuso at the time when this ancestor went to practice with this other teacher. He was like a senior student in the assembly, and at the time that Shuso said, oh, this guy is kind of like on to something here. But then later he left and secluded himself on Mount Xiang, and the wild animals there did not trouble him. Late one night, he was enlightened. So, which I think is just, to make a little note here, again, it uses this word Satori. So this was when he was younger, he had this Satori. And then in this story we just read, he had this Satori. So it looks like it's not like a one-time thing. And Satori literally means, you know, it's kind of a loaded word in English, right? Satori. But it literally just means like to understand. It's not really just a Zen word, it's just in the Japanese language it means you can satori something, you can realize or understand something. Zen has this connotation like really understand, deeply understand. So he understood one night while sitting on the mountain, and he sought confirmation of his understanding from Yen Sho, another teacher. But then he went back to practice with priest Sung Chu. So the one that was the Shuso at this other temple, he went back to practice with him. On this Tendo Sogaku was the abbot at Mount Tiantung, and he appointed Shui Do to the important position of clerk. Shoki, which in, at least in modern Soto Zen, we don't have this at like Tassajara, this position. We have lots of different, you know, positions in the monastery, but it's basically like the Benji. In modern times, the Shoki is like assistant to the Shuso. One day, the teacher brought up the above situation in this case. This situation occurs in the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, scroll 5 in the chapter on Tathagata nature, or Buddha nature. This, we're talking about the Mahayana Parinirvana Sutra, which is this huge treatise that became a huge scripture that was popular in the Zen schools, and is actually currently being translated into English. There was an old, a little bit funky translation. It's been around, but there's a brand new one. Like a third of it just came out. It's one of these 1,000 pagers. So they're working on it. But it's particularly, this sutra particularly emphasizes Buddha nature. That's its kind of the theme. So in the sutra, Kashyapa, Mahakashyapa, Bodhisattva said to the Buddha, O world-honored one, according to what the Buddha has said, all Buddhas, world-honored ones, speak with a hidden meaning. or use intimate language. But this is not what he means. Why? All Buddhas, world-honored ones, have a hidden meaning, not a hidden body of teaching. So maybe it's time to look at this word hidden, or secret, or intimate. So it's this, in Japanese we say mitsu. And this means secret. The dictionary would say like secret or fine. And intimate maybe doesn't usually say in the dictionary, but I think that's good. Intimate. We have this saying, maybe you've heard, men mitsu no kafu. It's like, men is like cotton fabric, and mitsu is this word that means like intimate or like fine, very fine. So men mitsu is like the fineness of like a tightly woven cotton fabric. And together this means like kind of like intimate attention to like detail and careful attention, you know, and everything matters. The way we like hold the sutra book and the way we untie the bowls and this careful attention to detail is the kafu. Kafu is the wind of the house. The house wind is kafu. So Nemitsu no kafu is a Soto Zen saying that say, people ask, what's the style of Soto Zen as compared to like Rinzai Zen or as compared to Shingon school or Pure Land school? How would you sum up the style of Zen? It's intimate attention to detail. Or maybe we could, to detail of, you know, forms and rituals, but also I think intimate attention to each other and to everything. It's very like, it's an intimate, careful style. I think Rinzai Zen, I don't know, they probably have a kafu phrase like this too, but it just has a flavor of a little bit more like, you know, rigorous and strong, maybe, would be more Rinzai flavor, like, just do it! But do we bow here, like, just do it! Where it's like, oh, no, let's talk about it. Step over here. You can hold your hands just like this. It's very beautiful. I think it's maybe more accessible in our culture too, because it's kind. I think it's kind, careful, attentive, and our relationships are kind, careful, and attentive. You know, we try. This is the style, the wind of our house. So this mitsu, in this case of mitsu, means it doesn't mean secret. Actually, in this case, it really means more like fine, intimate. You know, maybe almost it's so intimate that the full extent of it is almost hidden. It's maybe subtle would be another word. So mitsu is also used in the as I mentioned, Shingon means mantra. So the Shingon school in Japan is the kind of esoteric mantra yana of Japan. But another name for Shingon is Mikkyo, and that's abbreviation of mitsu kyo. So it's the kyo means like teaching, so it's like, in this case, I think it does mean more like secret, but maybe more like esoteric. It's, you know, sometimes people would say Vajrayana is like the esoteric school of Buddhism. And esoteric in English, I think, means something like kind of focusing on the inner, subtle inner qualities, as opposed to exoteric is like the outer. The outer teachings, the obvious outer teachings. If you grasp, you will suffer. It's a basic outer teaching that's accessible to everyone. And the inner teaching is maybe an esoteric teaching would be like, actually, if you look really closely, the very nature of grasping itself is perfect nirvana. Maybe we'd say that it's like kind of almost an esoteric teaching. It's harder to see. It's not exactly secret, but it's like in Tibetan Buddhism they have this term self-secret, and so there's certain texts that, like tantric texts, that are like, in America now they're dealing with this, of like people translate these amazing works and they're like, this is not accessible to the general public. It's, you have to, even on Shambhala books, there's a bunch of books that you can't just buy without written permission from your teacher. We don't have that in Zen, right? And they're like, so some Tibetan teachers are really strict about that, like, we shouldn't even really, Shambhala publishers shouldn't even really do this, because somebody's just going to make up, say, well, my teacher said it's okay. And we can't let these out, because there'd be like, people will misunderstand them, and then that will like diminish the power of the teaching, actually. It's kind of almost like defiles the teaching by people's misunderstanding. So only those who are initiated into it, who have the oral transmission from their teacher about the inner meaning, can read it. Some teachers say that, and some Tibetan teachers say, well, actually these texts are self-secret, meaning like anyone can read them, because actually they won't understand them. And they're self-secret, meaning like, if the meaning's been unpacked by somebody, then, oh, wow, this is amazing. But if it hasn't, it's just like, what? Why would I want to read this anyway? This is ridiculous. It's like nonsense. And I think maybe some Zen teachings we could see like this. Maybe koans, right? We could see, we could maybe call like self-secret, in the way that if you just read it having never heard about any of this, it's like, what? Maybe this story you just heard. The World Honored One spoke with a hidden meaning, but it was not concealed at Kashyapa. Why did somebody start crying with joy upon hearing this? I don't get it. Maybe it's self-secret. And it's kind of nice that this story is about like self-secret, and the story itself is self-secret. So then some of these Tibetan teachers say, you can release these texts, it won't cause any harm, because people won't like so much misunderstand them, they just won't get them at all. So here in the Nirvana Sutra, Kashyapa Buddha is saying, all Buddhas speak with these mitsugo, these intimate words or hidden words or secret meaning, not a hidden body of teaching. Or not a concealed teaching. In this case, in Japanese, mitsuzo. So the Buddhas speak with mitsugo, intimate words, self-secret words, not with secret body of teachings. And the zo in this case is like, is the zo, shobogenzo, like storehouse, or it can also mean like to hide or conceal. So it's a little kind of wordplay here. The Buddhas use mitsugo, not mitsuzo. They use this intimate speech, but they don't hide their teachings. It's like a magician's mechanical man. Even though people see it lean over, stretch, and look up and down, they do not realize that there's something inside it that makes it the way it is. This is from this Parinirvana Sutra. This is strange. I know I had to kind of think about this for a while. I understand this to be like that, that the magician is trying to like fool people into like, there's, this is magic. This, look, this wooden robot can just move on its own. It's got like a magic mind, but actually there's a little motor inside it. I don't know what they had in old India, but there's like, is an explanation how this robot works. But the magician is trying to trick people that there's some hidden thing. And Kashyapa says, the Buddha Dharma is not like that, but instead allows people to understand completely. In other words, the Buddha is not trying to fool people, saying, isn't there, there's some mysterious thing in here. He's actually trying to help everyone understand. How could it be said that the Buddhas have a secret body of teachings? And the Buddha then praised Kashyapa and said, very good, very good. Good child of Buddha. As you say, the Tathagata truly has no secret body of teachings. Why? Just as the full moon in autumn is clear and exposed in the sky, pure and unobscured and seen by everybody, so are the Tathagata's words. He utters them clear and exposed, pure and unobscured. Deluded people say that it's a secret body of teachings, but the wise understand completely and don't call it a secret body of teaching. And then Kazan says, since then this expression has been used for a long time by followers of the ancestral teachers. Therefore, when it was brought up here, Secho Chikan was awakened. It was truly not concealed. So you follow the gist a little bit, that the teaching, the Buddha is never trying to hide these teachings. It's not actually esoteric in Zen. There are maybe esoteric teachings, the Mantrayana has, but Zen teachings are not actually esoteric. But the way to convey something so subtle, it seems like the words are like secret words. Well, it's nice. I think this word mitsu doesn't really have to mean secret. It can just mean like intimate words. So Kaz Tanahashi translates it as intimate words, intimate speech.
Are you thinking comments?
Sure.
Well, I'm just thinking, the way I'm hearing this is, it's like there's a part that the receiver has to do. It's like, you know, when I'm thinking of, say, when I first started practice and I read Dogen and it was like, what does this mean? And it's not like I figured it out, but somehow in the process of practice, it just started to make more sense.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking with this, it's not so much that, I mean, they're hit, what's hidden is that the unfolding just has to happen. Is that?
I think that's pretty good, yeah. We have to work with it from the receiver's side. We have to make the effort to meet this. What is this? And that effort is, how does that happen? What kind of effort is that? I think it's like partly about hearing it over and over, which we're subjected to in this kind of a sashin. Hearing these stories and strange, intimate words over and over, and oh, sometimes little pieces of it click, right? Oh, that phrase I've heard over and over that was just like, why did they put it like that? Like, finally kind of clicks and like, oh, I just see it in a new way. Maybe a little satori of it. And actually, wow, what a beautiful and straightforward way to put something. Actually, now that I see how it's put, because it's something quite subtle. Hard to say with non-intimate words. Yeah. Oh, so that's a nice point. Thanks. Mitsugo. So this is Dogen's fascicle called Nichigo, Intimate Words. Or this is Kazutani Hashi says, intimate language is the same thing as spoke with a hidden meaning, spoke with a secret meaning. It's the same, just different translation. Intimate language. And interestingly, the same phrase that's the catalyst for Secho Chikan's awakening in this story we just heard is brought up here, like with Yunju. Remember, it said, you must be the one that Yunju predicted, and there's no commentary on what that means, actually. So that's, I don't know about that. It looks like Kazon didn't know about that either. But Yunju was his previous ancestor, and it may be related to this story. Maybe, because this story is about Yunju. Yunju was asked by an imperial minister who brought an offering to the temple. The imperial minister said, the world-honored one had intimate language, and Mahakashapa did not conceal it. What was the world-honored one's language? So again, he quotes the same section from this Nirvana Sutra, which was going around in the Chinese Zen world, it seems like, several generations earlier. Yunju was asked, the world-honored one used, you know, you could say, secret words, or in this case, the world-honored one had intimate language, used intimate language, and Mahakashapa did not conceal it. I think another nice translation is, it was not hidden to Mahakashapa. These intimate, almost secret words were not hidden or secret to Mahakashapa. What was those world-honored ones' intimate language? Yunju said, your excellency. Yes, he responded. Yunju asked, do you understand it? The minister said, no, I don't. Yunju said, if you don't understand it, then the world-honored one had intimate language. If you do understand it, Mahakashapa did not conceal it. Another strange self-secret story. So again, people were investigating, what is this intimate language? The world-honored one used this intimate, fine, careful, almost secret language, but it was not concealed or hidden to Mahakashapa. What was, or what is, the Buddha's intimate language? Your Excellency. Yes? Do you understand? No, I don't. If you don't understand it, the world-honored one had intimate language. Or maybe we could even say, you're not understanding it, shows this, the Buddha's intimate language. Like, something in our conversation here. Mr. Minister, yes? Do you understand? No. It's very good. It's not understanding means the world-honored one had intimate language. If you understand it, that means Mahakashapa did not conceal it, or it was not hidden to Mahakashapa. So something about not understanding is in the realm of this intimate language. So playing with this, you know, what is understanding? In this case, we could look at the understanding as a kind of conceptual, intellectual understanding of something. Oh, I understand. Yeah, this means that, and I got it. And but no, I don't understand. This is the realm of like not knowing. Not knowing is most intimate. And so then Dogen proceeds to comment for some pages about this. Of course, Here's a little bit of Dogen on this Mitsugo, this intimate language, secret words. When you encounter a person, you invariably hear intimate language and speak intimate language. When you know yourself, you know intimate action. Thus, Buddhas and ancestors can thoroughly actualize this intimate heart and intimate language. You should know that where there are Buddha ancestors, intimate language and intimate action are immediately manifest. Intimate means close and inseparable. There's no gap. Intimacy embraces Buddhas and ancestors. It embraces you. It embraces the self. It embraces action. It embraces generations. It embraces merit. It embraces intimacy. When intimate language encounters an intimate person, the Buddha eye sees the unseen. Intimate action is not known by self or other, but the intimate self alone knows it. Each intimate other goes beyond understanding. Since intimacy surrounds you, it is fully intimate. It is beyond intimate. That's a nice Dogen celebration of intimacy. Or secrecy. Secret is really not quite the right word in this case, right? Intimate means close and inseparable. There's no gap. It embraces you. This is the kind of intimacy that is used in the Buddha's language. And he just ends with this poem by old Master Shui Do, which is a current ancestor. So maybe because he had this awakening with this story, later he wrote this poem that says, "The world-honored one has intimate language. Mahakashapa does not conceal it. Night rain causes the blossoms to fall. The fragrant water reaches everywhere." And then Dogen says, "Night rain causes the blossoms to fall and the fragrant water reaches everywhere," spoken here by Shui Do, "are intimate." Aren't they? You should study this and examine the eyeballs and nostrils of the Buddhas and ancestors. This is not somewhere that Lin Ji or Dushan can arrive. So that's this. Those are both in this other house wind style. Lin Ji and Dushan are maybe a little bit more like fierce and direct. They're like, just shut up and do it. In a, of course, very grandmotherly kind way. Like, stop wavering. Just cut directly through. Whereas Soto style is more like, night rain causes the blossoms to fall. Fragrant water reaches everywhere. With the entire body and mind, study the realm where the eye, where the ear, nose, and eye are neither old or new. Open the nostrils within the eyeballs and sharpen the nose tip within the ears. The fragrant water reaching everywhere, spoken of by Shui Do, conceals the body and reveals light. That's why this passage from the Nirvana Sutra is studied and penetrated. Conceals the body and reveals light. That's the in the Dokusan room, there's some calligraphy by Katagiri Roshi that says concealing the body. Maybe from this fascicle. We conceal the body, hide the body in the moonlight, for example. The light is revealed. So, now this is Kazan's commentary on the story. When you hear words, you must know their inner meaning and not get trapped by the words. This is kind of, right, this is what we're, what this is pointing to, these intimate language is knowing the inner meaning of the words, not getting trapped by the words. Saying fire is not fire, and saying water is not water. Therefore, you don't burn your mouth when you say fire, nor is your mouth wet when you say water. Obviously. And yet, that's a nice point. That sticks and stones may break our bones, but words can never harm us. You must realize that fire and water are not words. Priest Shirto said, hearing the words, you should understand the source. Don't make up standards on your own. Sounds familiar to us. One of our chants. Also, Yao Shan said, you have to look yourself. You cannot eliminate language. I am saying these words right now, and they reveal what is unspoken. Who is that one who lacks ears, eyes, and so on right from the beginning? So, both of these are ancestors in our lineage. And Yao Shan says, you can't eliminate language. I mean, how could we, right? I mean, we can be quiet during Sesshin, but even when we're quiet, right, there's inner language going on. We can't eliminate it. And actually, we use it. I'm saying these words right now to reveal what is unspoken. This is an intimate language. Also, Zhang Qing said, the 28 generations of Indian ancestors spoke of transmitting mind, not of transmitting words. Master Yun Men said, if this matter existed beyond words, wouldn't the 12-part canon of the three vehicles be wordless? Meaning, like, this technical way of saying the whole canon of the Buddhist sutras and teachings. If the if this matter existed beyond words, wouldn't the whole like canon of teachings be wordless? Why do we speak of a special transmission outside the scriptures? If you proceed by using intellectual understanding like the saints of the 10 stages, then even though your preaching of the Dharma is like clouds and rain in its abundance, you will be criticized for seeing essential nature as if through gauze. So, we can talk about all these teachings, but if we're just getting it in the words, it's like seeing our true nature through, like this. It's like, okay, I can see you all through here, but you're kind of blurry and gray. You should realize as a result of this that all discriminating minds are as apart from it as heaven and earth. Though this is how it is, if you're a thoroughly accomplished person, you won't burn your mouth when you say fire. You can talk all day and nothing will cling to your lips and teeth. You won't utter a word. I mean, it sounds simple, right? But actually, isn't this a tough point? Like, words are, we get so caught up in words and believing that they're actually what's happening. So therefore, often words do hurt us much more than sticks and stones. We're really just like linking the word with the reality is, you could say, the basic delusion. That's called conceptual thought. That's breaks the world in the world of one suchness into myriad objects, and self and other, all created through words. And this, I think, means, you know, spoken words, but also just internal concepts. Even if we don't even quite have a word for it, the conceptual mind that's like categorizing things and dividing reality into pieces, which is very natural, we're basically doing all the time, is the it's painful. It's painful to believe that the concepts and the words are reality. And yet, if we just do away with them, this habit is so deep, we just continue it. One might say, well, once we learn to just let go more and more deeply, wouldn't it be better in sesshin to just not use any words? Well, we sometimes do have the no toys sesshin. Or let's not have any words for this week at all, and just let go of the words. But in this case, we're maybe adding more words than usual to see, both to point at the subtlety of how words are create pain, and how intimate words can reveal the truth. And trying to use words in this intimate way. And this is the style of using intimate words that's being passed down. Monks, you should know that there is someone. this is that classic Kaizen thing now. Someone with a capital S. Right, so Dogen doesn't, this is this case, Dogen doesn't talk this way, but Kaizen's now saying, monks, you should know there is someone who is not only speechless, but also mouthless. Not only is he, so I'm not sure exactly how this goes in Japanese, but he with a capital H, right? This is like, interesting, I think. Not only is he mouthless, or her, right, or she. Not only is he or she with a capital H or S mouthless, but she also has no eyes. From the beginning, he has not possessed a hair's worth of the four elements and six senses. Though it is like this, it is not emptiness, nor is it nothingness. Even though you say you see things and hear sounds, it's not your eyes seeing or your ear hearing. It is this faceless fellow doing it. And this translator, capital F faceless, capital F fellow. Almost a little theistic, could we even say? Christians in the room might appreciate Kaizen's style. Yeah. All these capital letters. Your mind and body were provided by this fellow. Therefore, the mind and body are not at all created things. If you haven't reached this point, then you may think that your body was created as a result of your parents, and that your body is a result of karma. Thus, you may think that your body resulted from the union of sperm and egg, or that your body is covered with skin and flesh. This is because you have not thoroughly clarified self, with a capital S. Yeah, you follow that part? This is, I think, great Zazen instruction. You can, you know, carry this through the day. It seems like, when we think about it, didn't this body come from our parents and the food we ate and the and our, you know, karmic activities up to the present? Kazen's saying, well, it appears that way. The apparent body, when we talk about cause and effect, we can tell that story, and yet he's implying that your body, I think he's talking about your body here, is not covered with skin and flesh. Your body that is that old fellow, that old gal.
Capital G.
Capital G. Is that a good feminine equivalent of fellow, do you think? Gal? Fellers. In order to get to know this realm, spiritual teachers use unlimited means to get you to put an end to the six senses and stop everything. At such a time, there is something that cannot be destroyed, something that cannot be crushed. When you become aware of it, it surely cannot be reduced to emptiness or existence, nor is it bright or dark. Therefore, it is hard to talk about whether you are deluded or enlightened. To put an end to the six senses and stop everything. So, you know, just a word about that as a practice, right? We have to be careful that, let's do some kind of like meditative lobotomy thing. Just like shut down the senses. And I think there are various meditations where we can actually, through very strong intention, almost like shut down the senses. Buddhist and non-Buddhist meditations, but the style of the Buddhas and ancestors is to not shut down anything. It's more to drop off everything. Maybe quite a subtle difference. So, sitting, opening the grasp, the body's grasp. The body grasps through tension, it seems usually, the muscular tension. And when I look at this, I think there are some muscular tensions when we're like, you know, holding a heavy weight or something, the muscles are there, but we're sitting zazen, and there's like increasing muscular tension. It seems, in my experience, it seems like it's always based on mind. Like there's some mental grasping that's causing the bodily tightness. And you can check it out. Maybe there's some muscular tension that just holds us upright. But anything beyond that, seems like the mind is creating a some sort of fixation. Maybe we can't even quite name what it is, but I think Sesshin is definitely the time and place to investigate this type of phenomena. And therefore, sometimes we notice, actually, I'm not relaxed now, my breath is short, and there's some feeling of struggle, and it's all my body. But then we can look deeper and maybe see, oh, what if I actually just give some instruction to maybe the whole body-mind experience, like just, it's okay to relax. Very gently, we can invite ourselves. And sometimes, oh, there it is. See that, like, actually, like, Maybe those are kind of intimate, gentle words. It's okay to relax. Even when I say it right now, I notice some like physical relaxation. And so I think there's, because we're using language and ideas here, I think it's not just like the body talking to the body. There's some words, and the mind is connected here too. So body and mind really can't be separated. But when there's tension in one, there's tension in the other, it seems to me. And when one relaxes, the other relaxes. And so this, the ancestors, Keizan says, teach us to stop the six senses and stop everything. Or is it cut off? To put an end to the six senses and stop everything. So, we could say, basically putting an end to the grasping around the six senses. I think the big, maybe the dominant sense of the five physical senses during Sesshin. What would you say? The one that we notice most? Yes, that's one I notice most. The body sense, the physical sensation. We can get involved in the hearing a little bit. The visual sense, not very much. Smell and taste, a little during the meals. But this bodily sense goes more and more prominent. As the hours pass. So, what is it to not grasp around that sense? Grasping is holding or aversion, to totally relax into sensation being sensation. I would understand Keizan to mean like that. Deeply letting it all be beyond our concepts of this is a big problem, or like, isn't it great that I'm enduring this, or anything else. Put an end to grasping the senses and stop everything. Just cease the spinning mind. How? I think we just sit some more. but what can I do about it? I think that's the, in Sesshin anyway, this is what we say. If we're just sitting one period during the day, maybe we can't say sit some more because we only have time, then we need other, maybe we need some other teachings. But nice in Sesshin, we don't maybe need much of anything, so just sit some more. And, we'll remember. We'll remember eventually, or we'll learn through our own experience. Actually, when I just let go and relax, everything can become very clear and undisguised and simple. And if I try to like, but there must be something more reliable than that. What is it? And then we're like spinning again. For this reason, this realm is not called Buddha, Dharma, mind, or essential nature. It's not called any of these things. It is nothing but bright light existing brilliantly. It is nothing but bright, clear light, luminosity. Therefore, it's not the light of fire or the light of water. It is just boundless clarity and brightness. You cannot see it, though you try, nor can you acquire it, though you try. It is just alertness. When the three disasters of water, fire, and wind occur, and the world is destroyed at the end of the eon, according to Indian Buddhist cosmology, the kalpa, this incredibly long time span, will eventually come to an end through this like massive firestorm destroying the entire universe. And then, you know, after some time passes, a new one will arise, which parenthetically, I think is pretty much in accord with like modern astrophysics. It's kind of like that, you know. Universe is not like a permanent thing. It's like it expands to a certain dimension and then it starts contracting again. Maybe this is the one version of a modern physical way, and then it eventually like collapses into itself and disappears. But then hopefully I say it's this little speck of tiny person in this vast vast array of universes. Hopefully there'll be another universe someday. Wouldn't it be nice? Wouldn't it be nice? But anyway, for our lifespan, we probably won't know any other ones. But anyway, when that all happens, at the end of the, when the whole universe is destroyed, it is not destroyed. That's a nice one. The whole universe is gone, but wait a second, there's still this old fellow. Where does he live if there's no universe? This emphasis on luminosity, I think, is interesting because I was at a Tibetan Buddhist retreat last summer and ran into a bunch of old students of Suzuki Roshi who, I guess after Suzuki Roshi died, they, looking for another teacher, they discovered Trungpa Rinpoche, and ever since they've been practicing in the Shambhala community, Tibetan Buddhism, that lineage, but have, you know, great fondness and respect for Zen and Suzuki Roshi, and we were standing in a line or something, and so we're kind of chatting about this, and then saying, yeah, you know, I really feel like Trungpa really embodied Suzuki Roshi's teaching, and I said, yeah, I love these Dzogchen retreats because I feel like they're like the essence of Zen. And one of them was like, I feel like very similar to Zen too. I think I said something like, what do you think is the difference? I think one was saying, I don't think quite the same. That old fellow said, the difference is luminosity. He said, Zen seems to just emphasize like the emptiness of no eyes, no ears, no nose, but these Tibetan teachings of like Dzogchen and Mahamudra really emphasize this brightness and luminosity of mind. And I said, oh, that's all through Soto Zen, especially Keizan. Mm-hmm. Keizan Zen, I think, is really emphasizes the luminosity. Dogen has a chapter called Luminosity also. Best wishes to you all till we meet again. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of the old fellow's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.